Welcome to Super Together. I am James Cochran, and we've got a special guest today, and his name is Tino Herrera. Tino, you want to say hi?
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
And if Tino sounds not terrible, as he usually does when he records in his laundry room, it's because he's actually in the studio with me, and he is about 6 feet away from me. We are properly socially distanced. And, you know, Tino, a cynical person would look at me and say, it seems like James only knows two brown people because they're the same two brown people that come and talk on all this podcast.
I know. I was actually going to say that. I'm hoping that people are not getting tired of just, you know, hey, Tino's back again, or Tino's going to speak to us here. But it is true. You probably only know one brown Latino person.
Well, maybe two or three others. But that's something we can talk about. Tino is here, as everybody knows, hopefully. We are in the midst of an awakening. I was in a community this morning, and the word groggy felt like the right word. And then maybe that's the most generous word to apply to it. If you think about the range of human experiences when they wake up in the morning, some people are cranky. Some people are angry. Some people are kind of confused and tired. Some people are ready to go. But our country broadly is waking up to the reality that we have not been about liberty and justice for all in the way that we've claimed to be. And that is most readily apparent in the way that people of color, black, indigenous, and people of color are giving voice to the consequences of police brutality that they've been enduring for several hundred years, but have been enduring on camera for the past 10 years, dozen years or so. And we're a relationships podcast, and we're trying to figure out what it looks like to be in right relationship with one another. And I think that that question is one that of late Ginger and I have largely been exploring in the space of community, in the space of our friendships and those types of things. Now we've had some conversations about coupled relationships, but Tino, you are a pastor, so you have responsibility for caring for like a big community, you know, large groups of people with diverse opinions and experiences and ways of understanding the world around them. And so as each of us starts to consider what it looks like to be in community, to be in relationship with our sisters and brothers of color, I just thought we could kind of get your insight and see what that's looked like for you. And maybe we'll start by saying, how have you seen your community, the one that you're most closely connected to, respond to this moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first, let me, I think, you know, as I reflect on that question, how has, you know, my community, being a pastor, right, and being one of the pastors of my community, you know, we are called, we are sent out by our bishop, right, to, mm-hmm. to preach truth, to take thou authority. So that means the responsibility for us is to proclaim truth in mm-hmm. general, right? So, however, given the times that we're living in, right, somebody asked me a great question the other day. It's like, what's the, you know, you're bringing awareness to this issue of race and racism within our country and within our communities. But I remember, you know, hearing this stuff back when the Trayvon Martin mm-hmm. case blew up. I remember when Charleston blew up and we were talking about it. And even when Ferguson hit, you know, in 2017. And so now all of a sudden we're back here looking at mm-hmm. George Floyd, reflecting on George Floyd and the many other events that led up to that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of the things that's causing us really to do some deep soul searching, not only as my community, but for all of us, is that we are in this this pandemic, mm. right? In other words, not to say that if we didn't have a pandemic going on and this race issue was coming up, that we wouldn't give attention to it. I just don't think that we would be able to be in this moment of being still mm. and being in this, immersing ourselves, right? We can't get away from it, right? Yeah. There's nothing to help us get away from it. We can't go on vacation. We can't watch sports. We can't go to the movies. We can't. So we're kind of really just mm-hmm. having to immerse ourselves. And that is been healthy for some folks. It's been challenging for some folks. It's been even at times the word fear I hear all the time comes mm-hmm. up around folks, because it was fear of what they didn't know, of what they didn't understand.
Yeah.
And so I think that is really one of the things that's really helping us really just turn the page when yeah. we talk about racism in America and even within our own communities. That being said, I look at the kingdom of God, what Jesus preached, mm-hmm. and what that looked like, right? The feeding, the going out and to the marginalized, to the oppressed, being a voice for the voiceless, right? He says that in the beginning of his ministry. And so I started looking at other authors who had this same concept of what that community looked like. And of course, I always turn to one of my favorite prophetic writers, pastors, as we all know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Now, for those of you that don't know, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a civil rights activist in the 1950s and 60s who spent a lot of time and energy working toward various dimensions of racial equality. I'm mostly being sarcastic because I think hopefully most people know who Dr. King is, but tell me what you, when you found yourself diving into that and figuring out what those things might be calling us toward.
So
what did you start to find?
As you're looking through his writings, as you're reading some of his sermons, you know, I came across one that that I really didn't, I never had read before. And he was giving it during the Montgomery boycott era, when the Montgomery was boycotting their buses, you know, because of segregation. And it was in 1956, he really preached on a sermon about unity and about community. Now, the sermon title wasn't called The Beloved Community, but he didn't coin the phrase, but he used the phrase The Beloved Community. It was actually coined by another theologian and a philosopher, Josiah Royce. Mm. But other civil rights leaders, you know, were really trying to dive into what it means to be the beloved community. Dr. King just really expanded on that. Mm. And it wasn't just about, you know, combating racism. It was about universal health care. Mm-hmm. It was about universal education for all. It was about equality, right? This is where we get really into the part of what we don't really talk about Dr. King, right? He was this civil rights leader, right, that was really promoting universal change. Mm-hmm. And so people get it twisted. You know, we love to post up memes about Dr. King and about, we love his quotes and, you know, just love, right? But let's not get it twisted that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was not well liked mm-hmm. back in the 60s, right? And because he was preaching on these things. But he really expanded on this beloved community where we really could live in unity, where we really could come together, sharing our resources, really living out to what the way Acts in chapter 2 describes, right? Where everyone had everything in common because we were sharing our resources.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He gave attention to that, and that was his future. So in order for us to get to the beloved community, we had to take some certain steps. We had to look at the past, right? We had to look at the present, and we had to look at the future, because the future is where we want to get to, right? But we can't get to the future until we look at our past, until we look at where we are now, in order for us to get there.
Yeah. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about a book that we've recommended here that I've been reading is How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. And every chapter in that book is a different dimension of the human experience and how race plays a role in that. And we're looking at things like class and like healthcare and like gender. So many of the different things that we think are somehow either secondary or tertiary or ancillary to race. But in reality, you're looking at broader principles that call us into relationship with each other. Race is a part of that, and probably one of the parts that has been most entrenched in American culture and maybe left unsuccessfully attended for so long, but there's more to being a beloved community than that. So I think part of what, as we consider this, one way of being in community, and we were going to leave our listeners with some kind of, like, you know, call to action toward the end of this. Don't worry, we still got time. Maybe we can unpack the question of how does James Cochran, how does Sally Joe McNoodleberg, how does the average person live into this idea of beloved community? So maybe start telling us, like, what does it actually look like specifically?
Yeah. So looking at, so let's just talk about, you know, race as a barrier or mm-hmm. racism as a barrier to, for us to living into the beloved community, right? So what does that look like? What do you and I need to have an awareness of? Well, for one is when we talk about racism, right? I think when we look at our past, right? So mm-hmm. I'm going to break this down. We have to understand how we got to where we are today. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, our country is embedded in racist policies, in systemic racism, mm-hmm. ideologies and narratives. I mean, I say this because when I first was getting this information, I was struggling with it. I didn't want to believe it, right? Because I was always taught in school that America is great, that mm-hmm. that we're not racist, right? That we don't have this, you know. And all of a sudden, when you start doing your research, you're starting to say, okay, this is why, you know, we're still kind of really fighting the same battles that we were fighting in the 60s and the 50s mm-hmm. and even into the 1800s, right? We just celebrated Juneteenth, mm-hmm. right? But we were struggling with that, at least for some of my friends who were Black. You know, they didn't necessarily see it as a celebration. They more saw it as an act of remembrance because mm-hmm. to them, they were like, yeah, we were free. That was a day when all of us were free, but we still had to endure mm-hmm. the Jim Crow laws, right? We still had to endure segregation. So necessarily, we mm-hmm. were still set up to fail, right? So again, you still start doing this research in the history. So I think living into the beloved community, you have to exegete your community. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Tell me.
So as exegete is a more of a seminary phrase for us pastors that were going into seminary, we look at a particular passage or verse and somewhat we dissect that passage. So in other words, we're looking at it through the lens of history. We're looking at it through the lens of experience. We're looking mm-hmm. at it the lens of tradition, right? We're putting all those pieces together, trying to figure out, okay, you know, what does this text really say for us today?
Yeah.
As we are in Kansas City, as we are in this county, right, we are exegeting our community. So we have to understand, wait a minute. My daughter, we lived up here for 3 years, and when we were watching the protests on the news, she had a really good question. She says, why are they protesting on the plaza and not downtown? Wouldn't mm-hmm. it make more sense for them to protest on the downtown than the plaza? Now, granted, we're not familiar with them, right? Mm-hmm. We're still getting to know our community, right? But as I exegeted mm-hmm. that area on the plaza, I, you know, did the work and I found out that, well, it's because of J.C. Nichols, which I had thought coming out here was deemed to be this great architect, this mm-hmm. this person who had this, you know, vast vision, you know, wanting to build businesses. But then I later found out that what he built was in a way discriminatory mm-hmm. towards people of color. Like literally he had tenants sign agreements that people who were brown, who were Black, who were Asian, who were Filipino could not buy property.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That should upset you. That should make you uncomfortable. That should challenge you, right? And so I think for one, as you live into the book, you got to know your community to make sure that you are not, A, remaining complicit, remaining silent, because some of the things that have been taken back in the past could still affect mm-hmm. the present and ultimately affect the future.
Yeah. It's, I think about this examination of the past is probably one of the things that in my conversations with people leave people most uneasy. I'm speaking mostly about white folks. But there's a consideration of, I didn't make tenants sign, you know, those papers. So what responsibility do I have? And part of what I invite them to consider is, how would the world look different if, those policies had never been enacted. So one of the things I love about Ibram X. Kendi's work is it sets there's racism and racist policies, a powerful collection of policies. He always defines racism in terms of a powerful collection of policies that lead to outcomes that favor one race over another. Right. That's what racism is. Mm-hmm. Less about an individual identity, an individual sense of malice, and more about like, how do we live in a world that creates these kinds of outcomes? And so you know, as we look at something like J.C. Nichols, we look at a racist policy that created outcomes where wealth was concentrated into communities where people of color could not live, which meant that there was less wealth, fewer resources available to communities where people of color lived. And what did that do to that world? And how would the world have looked different if those policies had been anti-racist, if those policies had been, you know, had distributed real estate resources and housing resources in a way that didn't disadvantage people of an entire race?
Right. And so then we get to the part where, right, we get to truce. Mm. And it's always been known as the historical line, mm-hmm. where it's kind of this racial dividing line, right? Yeah. And we wonder why that was. Well, you look back at our past, and the policies and the decisions that were made then have affected what we're seeing today.
Right. Right. And, you know, and part of what I've heard is that, you know, truce is moving, you know, the streets stay in there, but the dividing line's moving further east because developers are going to come in and gentrify, you know, the truce corridor. Yep. But again, that goes back to racist policies and anti-racist policies, which maybe speaks a little bit to the present, right? And saying, what are the things that are going on right now that we actually do have some influence to bring to bear, and how can we start to shape some of those things? So when you look at the present dimension of beloved community, what's that look like?
Yeah, so you always go to remembering, you go into exegete, but it continues on with, I think, now listening, mm-hmm. right? I think right now what we're seeing is that there are folks that want to respond with mm-hmm. good intentions, with goodwill, right? So I keep hearing folks that saying, now again, I'm coming off of the church, and so I'm hearing from people, you know, that they want, you know, black folks to join them in their small group, or we should go, build a program. You know, they're just coming up with ideas, which is great, good intentions. But I think right now the best thing that I think we could all do is learn mm-hmm. and listen to what's going on. Right. Yeah. Reading, educating ourselves, right. Getting familiar with history. But yes, but getting familiar with the policies that are in place today. Right. This stuff is not one and done. Yeah. You have to continue to take your time with it. You have to I'm a cook. I love to cook. Mm-hmm. So I always use the word marinate. You know, you got to marinate yourself in this work. It's not easy. It's challenging. It's hard. But at the same time, though, you could now start having conversations.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think I like the word marinate. I also like the word macerate, both of which I think describe a similar chemical process that's going on in your food, right? So if I'm marinating a food, essentially what I'm doing is I'm breaking it down.
Yeah.
And I'm breaking it down. And every single marinade that you're going to get is acidic. Yeah. It's painful. If you think, you know, the meat's already dead, but if you think about what's going on in the meat is having to come apart. That's what makes it tender. So there is a hardness with which we enter that marination process. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask ourselves, how can I allow myself to be softened here?
Yeah.
One of the morning practices that I've been starting to do is asking myself the questions, where am I prepared to greet the world with a no, with resistance? And how can I transition and soften that no to a yes? And when we think about these conversations that trigger a lot of defensiveness in us, I think that that's part of what we're called to do. Because even if you do the work of sitting down with somebody, even if you do the work of watching a documentary, if you do the work of reading a book, you might be inclined to do that in an argumentative frame of mind. You might be inclined to do that in a way that says, you know, well, here's what I was taught, or I didn't think it worked that way, or those types of things. I think sitting down and saying, and just acknowledging that you have something to learn, that there is a capacity to receive, guidance, wisdom, perspective, from those types of things. That's, I think, what it means to be in relationship. We are related to each other, connected to each other, in a way that isn't, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. You're remembering, then you're hearing, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say the next step then, right, as we look into the future, is your commitment, right? Because now you have remembered, you have looked at the past for what it is, you've exegeted it, you have now heard stories, you've now are starting to build upon relationships. So as you are coming out of these conversations and building relationships, you start to begin to think of action steps, mm-hmm. right? What are you committed to? You're committed to this anti-racist work, right? So when we talk about being an anti-racist, you are saying that you are calling out. It's not enough anymore to say, I'm not racist. Mm-hmm. It's not enough anymore to say, well, I didn't do that. I wasn't alive back then, mm-hmm. right? That's not what we're saying. Anti-racist says, I am committed to do the self-evaluating work on myself daily. It's almost like being in recovery, right? Mm-hmm. You're doing the checklist in yourself daily, right? And then you are committing to make action steps to call out mm-hmm. racist policies, racist narratives, racist behavior. You are calling it out and saying, this is not of the gospel. This is not of humanity. This is not going to be allowed here.
Yeah.
Right? So now, what do those action steps look like?
Yeah. You know, I was watching John Oliver's bit from this last week, and it was talking about coronavirus in prisons and jails. And I don't know if we've had discussions on this podcast, but I know that you and I have had discussions about the idea that prisons and jails are disproportionately filled with Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And in a lot of ways, that is the direct result of policies that have been put in place, a large combination of policies from the way that the law exists and the law has been enforced, the way that the justice system works, to the way that different types of educational resources have been distributed. There's a lot of different things that go into that. But that's part of what we're looking at. We're saying there is so much about the way that our world works that is racist in its outcomes that leads to the world being demonstrably more difficult for people of color, for Black and Indigenous people. And part of the work of anti-racism, of being able to participate in the beloved community, is that we don't get to turn a blind eye to it. We have to say, the world is harder for you. You're trying to start a small business, and it's harder for you to get a small business loan because you're Black, which is a fact. That's not okay. So how do I join you in trying to create a world in which that is no longer the case? And what does it look like to do that? In a lot of cases, it looks like how you vote, I would imagine. It looks like the types of initiatives that you support, the types of petitions that you sign. Right now, it's a lot of protesting, right? Because
the protesting is working. Mm-hmm. Let's not get it twisted, right? I've heard, protesters get lumped into this group of people who are, as what I would hear folks say, thugs and rioters mm-hmm. and looters, right? And that's a different story for a different day. But as far as protesting goes all the way back within our American history, within our civilization, even within our faith stories, right? Protest does work. We're seeing the change. And what people are protesting about when it comes to anti-racism work is the system. Let's take, for example, the justice system, mm-hmm. right? We're not saying that we're anti-cop, right? We're not saying that we are saying that there is a systemic embedded narrative ideology that has infected the criminal justice system, right? That is mm-hmm. That is out to criminalize Brown and Black people. This is statistically correct, right?
Yeah.
And so what we're saying is we want the system to be fixed. We're calling out the system for what it is, right?
Yeah.
As we should all organizations, companies, who are embedded in this narrative of racism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that to your point about, police and how, I think that there are some people who might be reluctant to take a stand in situations like that because they say, well, I love somebody who's a police officer. There's people that are important to me that are police officers, and I don't want to be against them. And that's, I think, part of why we say, listen, we are against policies. If you are a part of the beloved community, to be in the beloved community means to say, well, we have to be able to be welcoming and inclusive of all people, right? And that includes police officers. That includes bad people, but it does mean that we have policies of accountability, right? It means that we have policies that say if you hurt somebody, you need to be held accountable to that hurting. If you deprive somebody of life or liberty, you have to be held accountable to that deprivation of life or liberty. So I would agree. I think that it'd be easy to say, and I think that there are broad cultural narratives in play right now that are trying to delegitimize the Black Lives Matter movement, the broader efforts and energies toward being in right relationship with each other by being pretty reductionist, right? By instead of saying words about protest, they use dog whistles like riot. And I think part of what you're pointing to is the fact that we need to recognize that we're not vilifying human beings here. Yep. We are insisting that policies that make the world a more difficult place for people of color, that those policies be corrected. Yep. So that the world can be a better place for all of us. And from your perspective as a pastor, you're looking at this like, this is what the kingdom of God is. And so is that, I mean, so when King, from your reading and study, when King envisioned the beloved community, and we think about our community in Kansas City, or really any city, what would someone like me go and do today, that would help us be closer to the beloved community? And Tino, if you wouldn't mind, would you break some things in my office?
So a couple of things I would say is, for one, first of all, if take a look at your environment, mm-hmm. right? What you are watching, what you are hearing, what you are reading, who you hang out with, right? I'm gonna challenge our listeners here that if you don't know someone that doesn't look like you, that doesn't even have the same beliefs as you, I'm going to encourage you to go out there and have coffee or mm-hmm. lunch with someone, right, of a different race, of a different background. Put that out there, right? That's how you start building on more inclusivity, right, is that you're getting out of your comfort zone and you're learning about somebody else. The other thing is that continue to educate yourself, right? The phrase, right, what is it? Help me out, James, when we talk about books. Right?
You haven't gotten me any, you've given me no leads. How am I supposed to help you?
Well, knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. Francis
knowledge
Bacon.
Is power. There you go.
Yeah. My first radio show was called The Knowledge Hour, where knowledge is power. Yeah, go ahead.
Knowledge is power, right? And the sad thing is that you're not always going to get that knowledge in academic institutions. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Oklahoma. And
where they didn't have any academic institutions.
Stop. I will say, though, it was required by the state of Oklahoma that we would have to take a course, a yearly course on Oklahoma history, mm-hmm. right? And so I took it my senior year. It was somewhat of as an elective, right? We were just learning about our state. I did not, nor were we, first of all, we were not taught about the Tulsa race riots, mm-hmm. right? That's only 2 hours away from Oklahoma City. I did not know about the Tulsa race riots until I started grad work, mm-hmm. which was in 2014. So tell me from 2000, my junior year, to then 2014 years later, I finally found out about the Tulsa race riots. My own mm-hmm. home state, I just couldn't believe it, right? Mm-hmm. And then you started doing more, right? So again, I say that with a grain of salt. Knowledge is power. So continue to read up on prolific authors, prophetic authors. Look back at their writings. You know, we can look at Dr. King's writings, right, because they still speak to us to this mm-hmm. day. But also look at the young voices that are speaking to us today, like Professor Kendi, right, who is mm-hmm. doing really the work of anti-racism, the anti-racism work, right, and helping us be better in countering that. Mm-hmm. So
I wanted to jump in on just one thing you quickly said there. You know, educate yourself, yes, but I think one dimension of that is to make sure that you're challenging yourself.
Yeah.
You mentioned prophetic voices. The whole notion of a prophet was they got under people's skin and people didn't like them. Mm-hmm. If you're only reading things that confirm your bias, that make you feel comfortable, that make you say, oh, yeah, that's exactly how I see it, that's the way that things are, then you are probably, and that's at any point in the political spectrum.
Yep.
Consume information that challenges you, that makes you aware of things that you weren't aware of before. And I think that's where folks grow. You know, we call that zones of proximal development in child education, where it's like you do something hard, and then you give something a little bit harder. But that's, you know, just a little bit out of their reach. And it's only by giving those things that are just a little bit harder out of their reach that folks actually grow.
Yeah. You remind me of when I first started seminary. And, you know, I remember my first semester, I was angry. I was pissed off. I was frustrated because I had these professors and I had these readings that were assigned to me that were really challenging everything mm-hmm. that I believed, you know, growing up as a. And so I struggled. And mm-hmm. I wrestled and I was challenged. However, I can say that what I walked in as far as my theology going into seminary, it was broken apart. It was mm-hmm. torn apart. But over the next 3 years, I was able to build it back up with integrity, right?
Yeah.
And so it's with anything else, right? What we're seeing now for such a time as this is for us to really be in this moment to really committing ourselves to not only remembering, exegeting, but to hearing and then going forward with action steps.
Yeah.
That's how we're going to beat this thing. So it's a process. It's a journey, but it's a beautiful journey because it's what we're called to do.
Yeah. What would you say to folks who are just getting tired of all this? And some people are tired in the bad way, right? But some people are tired in the good way, you know, because they're just, they've been working hard. They feel like they've been posting the right things, reading the right things, having the right kinds of conversations. But it's tough work.
Yeah.
What would you say to them? How would they move through that?
Well, definitely take care of yourself, right? There's been times where I have been overwhelmed with everything that I'm reading and seeing and hearing, right? So you don't want to ignore it. You don't want to push it to the side because it's so easy to kind of really keep going and not staying on the course. So that's where self-care comes in. Right. So I don't know what that looks like for folks, but, you know, for me, it means, you know, maybe it's taking a day off from, you know, the computer, from Zoom calls, even taking a day off from media, social media, the news. Right. And reading a book for just enjoyment or exercising or fishing, whatever that is that gives you a breath of fresh air. Right. You really got to start taking care of yourself. Also, get around some good people that are going to meet you where you are, that are not going to, you know, say, oh, you should be believing in that or chastise you or belittle you or beat you down. But again, you're still getting that emotional support, as we would say, the beloved community, people that are walking with you on this journey.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Tino, anything you want to make sure that our listeners walk away with as they conceptualize what it means to be in communities that look more like the beloved community, anything else that you'd want to leave them with?
Yeah, I will say this. I'm going to quote Dr. King here. This is where really the beloved community was really expanded in his writings. The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. The type of love that I stress here is not an eros, a sort of aesthetic or romantic love, not a philia, a sort of reciprocal love between two personal friends, but it is agape love, which is understanding goodwill for all women and men. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. It is the love of God working in the lives of all of us. This is the love that may be well the salvation of our civilization. So the end is agape love. It is that self-sacrificial love, right, that sees the best in you, that hears the best in you, that walks with you, that transforms with you. So that's all I got to say. Hey, James, I love you. Thank you for another edition of this where I can come on and just bring my voice to the table.
No,
I appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to have you, Tino. And folks, if you want to get in touch, Tino's got a class that he's doing on the beloved community. Over 1,000 people are connected with this class. Where can they go if they want
to
be a part of it?
Yeah, you can go to core.cor.org/next. You can register for the class. We started last week. They're hour sessions, but then they're followed up with some Zoom rooms, which I'll be in one of them for Q&A. We're talking about what we're talking about today, right? What does it mean to be anti-racist? And then the next 2 weeks, we'll continue to flush and unpack what this beloved community looks like. So please join. Don't worry if you can't watch it on Wednesday nights. It'll be posted to the website the following day. But we really feel this is a great project going on.
Awesome. Tino, again, thanks so much for coming. Folks, if you want to get connected with Tino, you can go to core.org/next to get in touch with that class. You keep moving around the microphone. It's going to make all kinds of noise.
My bad.
That's fine. if you want to get in touch with me, you can go to talkingwithjames.com. We will be back next week. Ginger and I have some special planned. We'll see if we can make it happen. But one way or another, we'll see you guys next Friday. Be well.